This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Emily Bingham chose to become an author and historian, she set out one rule for herself. She would never write anything about her own family. The legendary Louisville media moguls had already been in the headlines far too much for stories about their family drama and politics. And then she started to learn more about her great aunt, Henrietta. And she couldn't hold herself back. Emily spent years sorting through hundreds of artifacts, including handwritten love letters, medical records, and a trunk full of colorful belongings. She found remnants of Henrietta's many love affairs with prominent men and women, like tennis star Helen Hull Jacobs and artists in the Bloomsbury Group. Emily's book is called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, and it puts a once-hidden family member back in the limelight. Author Emily Bingham joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Tell us a little bit more about the Bingham family. Let's start with that. You're the family that you come from and their Kentucky-based media empire.
Right. Well, that Kentucky-based media empire actually has its roots in North Carolina, which was something that definitely affected my decision to spend time there getting my graduate degree. But they were educators there. But the one who came to Louisville was not content to spend his life in a schoolroom teaching young boys and wielding a cane. So he married a woman from Louisville whose family were successful industrialists. And at this time, Louisville was a booming industrial town, river town, at the turn of the century. And Henrietta was born to them in 1901, and his ambitions carried him quite far in the end. He ended up purchasing the Louisville Courier Journal and Louisville Times, two daily newspapers, and ran for office and became a county judge and was actually called judge for the rest of his life in that old Southern way. And then served under FDR as an ambassador to Britain, but that family ownership continued through till 1986, when, following disagreements within the family, my own parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and so forth, and what I expected to be my legacy and was preparing for, sort of vanished in the course of a year or so, and Gannett now owns the Courier Journal. It does still operate.
But what you had there at the turn of the century was a prominent, wealthy, well-connected Southern family with a patriarch who everyone called Judge, and then a family secret. This is the stuff of the Gothic novel, and it made its way into the press for much of the 20th century, did it not?
It certainly did. Judge Bingham was someone who I think ended up deciding to become a newspaper owner, partly because he realized the power of the press in his own life. He was a very ambitious lawyer, got his law degree, and was sort of trying to work his way into the corridors of power in Louisville and Kentucky more broadly. And it wasn't easy for an outsider. He was from North Carolina, and he wasn't part of the inner clan. But it was the death of his first wife, a very sudden and terrible accident, where she lost her life in a collision with a train, which two of her children, including Henrietta, witnessed. A terrible scene. So that was 1913. 2 years later, he began to be involved with another great North Carolina family, the Keenans. And one of the Keenan women is someone he'd known as a young man growing up and going to Chapel Hill. And he knew her brother, William Rand Keenan, as well. And she was recently widowed as well. She had been married for the last 15 years or so to one of the wealthiest men in America. So Henry Flagler, you all may remember, was one of the Standard Oil partners, and he ended up developing the east coast of Florida, and that's Miami Beach and Palm Beach and the railroad and all of that. So when he died, about the same time that Bingham's wife died in Louisville, these two old flames came together. And it was a very dramatic thing, I mean, covered in the press, but it was even more dramatic when Mary Lilly passed away 7 or 8 months after their wedding, and in New York City, and she was living in Louisville at the time, and the circumstances were such that some of her family became concerned, and she had left a secret or surprise codicil to her will, leaving her last husband $5 million, which in 1917 was a big chunk of change.
All of this leads to a lot of press around the Bingham family, and it leads you to decide when you become a historian and a writer that enough has been said about your family, so you will set your sights on anything but. Is that right?
That's right, and I wrote my first book was an adaptation of work I did at Chapel Hill about a Southern Jewish family with wonderful North Carolina story, and I did seem to be drawn to families, mm-hmm. but this was a 18th and 19th century story and sort of a saga of their coming to America and finding their way and the price that exacted even as they met with success. But it was our naming of a daughter, Henrietta, in 1998, a long time ago now. But that name was one that my husband and I had simply liked. We liked the old-fashioned Victorian name. We liked Etta James and thought that would be a nice nickname. And I was myself pretty startled when my dear father came into the hospital room, looked at me and the baby and said, "How can you do this to her?" And I just said, "Well, I guess we need to talk."
What did you find out?
Well, I found out, you know, pretty quickly that there were stories about this figure in our family tree that no one had bothered to tell me, and because for my father specifically that he had witnessed situations where she was not completely in control. She was having some breakdowns in her later years when he was in his 20s, and this was painful, embarrassing, and the kind of thing you just didn't talk about. Just as we didn't talk about sexuality in the 60s and 70s very much, we certainly didn't talk about mental health either, and addiction, and things like that. And we certainly in my family didn't talk about Mary Lilly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think some of those things we're in a better position now in our culture to address. And so that was just the beginning. And I just thought, well, you know, she had a rough life. She was, you know, seemed to be a pretty extraordinary person who was willing to throw herself against the ramparts of a society and express herself, her sexuality, her incredible powers of attraction. She was willing to do that on both sides of the Atlantic and took great joy, and sometimes at least, in doing so. But that she, you know, ultimately had a difficult time, especially as the culture shifted after the Depression set in and into the 40s and 50s and 60s, where sexuality and homosexuality in particular were considered, you know, real neuroses and, you know, a mental illness in itself.
Well, I think this is fascinating because, as you point out, she had love affairs with both men and women, passionate love affairs, and we're going to get to some of the details as you discovered the trunk. I will take you up into the attic and talk about the trunk where you discovered the love letters and more. But what's interesting about all this is what you just said. In the 1920s, there was far more openness about being gay and lesbian, and so one could be open. And then when the door shut, there was Henrietta, who had gained this reputation, suddenly out in the cold. I mean, it shines a fascinating light on that particular moment in American history as well.
Right. She was being born in 1901, and with the wealth and privilege that she had at her disposal, she was able to catch that wave of the early 20s and into the early 30s at exactly the moment when she, you know, was a young adult. And so you can imagine how time can be such a timing in itself, can be such a radical shaper of our own life experience.
So now, let's take us into the attic in that trunk and how you learned about the trunk in the attic.
Well, I had been poking around about Henrietta in the 2000s because people kept bringing me these sort of, I end up calling them Henrietiana. I mean, just these odds and ends, whether, you know, beautiful cigarette holders with diamond-encrusted edges or letters or photographs or even linen sheets that had belonged to her, and stories of her being banished from Jefferson County, Kentucky for her non-conforming behavior by the police, no less. So these things kept itching at me, and I eventually said, okay, girl, I'll take a look at you. And I did what historians do, which is go to books, go to the library, go to indexes, and start going to archives and looking at letters. What was really ironic is that my father had told me, as before I even did that, that there was a trunk up in the attic that belonged to her, and I took a glimpse into it one day and saw a lot of old shoes and some other items of clothing and thought, well, okay, I'll get around to that. And when I finally did, several years later, get around to it on a cold January day in a mansion that I grew up in overlooking the Ohio, no one was even living there by that time, and I turned on the light in this grim garret room and opened that trunk and sat down with my yellow pad to take notes. I never expected that I would hit real pay dirt. And one piece of pay dirt was were a set of tennis clothes, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But the second thing was just as I was readying to leave, I'd been there for 6 or 7 hours. I was covered in grime. And I reached up to turn off the dangling light from the ceiling, and I saw another trunk in the corner. And reaching into that, it was tall, and I was up to my armpit, I found at the very bottom, under first editions of Virginia Woolf novels, about 200 beautifully preserved, carefully wrapped, yellow-ribboned letters in their envelopes from John Houseman, the wonderful later Hollywood actor and producer, and also a Bloomsbury sculptor named Stephen Tomlin. And both of these men, it turned out, had almost married Henrietta, who up till then I thought probably didn't have much to do with men in the 1920s.
Because those tennis clothes belonged to one of her lovers, Helen Hull Jacobs, right?
Yes, exactly right. And I looked at these clothes, and there was a monogram of HHJ, so that was a pretty good clue. And then the shorts, that was on the shirt, the top, and then on the shorts. And these were very man-tailored clothes, which in itself, I when I went and looked Helen Jacobs up, I realized they were quite historic in and of themselves, since Helen Jacobs was the first woman to dare to break with the tradition and give up the long skirts and stockings that all the other women players were using, and insist on her right to dress more freely the way men did on the tennis court. So I sent the pieces up to Newport, Rhode Island, where there is this tremendous, wonderful Tennis Hall of Fame, and it has a museum, and Helen Jacobs is one of the inductees to the Hall of Fame. And months later, I get a notice back from the curator saying, thank you for your donation. These will be a very nice addition to Helen Hull Jacobs' collection. And I called them up and said, well, excuse me, what would that be? And apparently at her desk, she left boxes and boxes of material. I got up there and only to find that there were diaries filled with the life she and Henrietta Bingham shared in London and in America from 1934 when they met at an embassy reception all the way through World War II when Helen was in the waves serving the Navy and Henrietta was stuck on a horse farm growing hemp for the war effort. Mm.
What also is remarkable about your discovery in these letters is the passion that she apparently and the spell that she cast over both men and women. Both talk about her charisma and her sexuality as being utterly, well, as the title of your book suggests, irresistible. This is quite a woman.
And that really did intrigue me. And I think that we historians very rarely have the, and we readers of history, right, very rarely have the opportunity to convey physicality in the past. And when I was interviewing one descendant of one of her lovers in the Bloomsbury group, this woman, also named Henrietta for Henrietta Bingham, claimed that her father told her, as a young woman, that Henrietta, when he took her to bed, blushed all over her body. Mm. And then you have John Houseman saying that just getting even a letter from her would let loose the dogs of longings at my vitals. And that, you know, imagining her always, another lover saying, imagining her always surrounded by adorers of every sex. And even her psychoanalyst, Ernest Jones, who was a very important figure in the history of psychoanalysis in London, he said, "And I shall bring her from women to men, and lucky the man will be."
Well, this brings us to another important part and a more sad part of the story, and it suggests how deeply fearful we are of Eros unleashed, because her passion led a lot of people to suggest that she have psychoanalysis and get fixed, which is part of what was going on there. Talk about psychoanalysis and then her later life struggling with depression and addiction.
Right. So even in the 1920s, when she was spending time playing a saxophone and hanging around and promoting the work of wonderful jazz artists, Henrietta Bingham's life was not all blues mamas and dancing the black bottom. She was coping with demons internal that were, you know, in addition to the cultural boundaries that she was, you know, running up against. So in the 20s, she goes to Smith College, which is a very, you know, forward, good thing for a girl to do, not so common for a Southern girl. She meets in her fall semester her English professor named Minna Kirstein, and Minna is only 4 years older than Henrietta, and it wasn't long before one fall weekend in New York at a Grand Hotel, Henrietta, as Minna says, made love to me in such a way that I had to admit that I was in love with her and she was in love with me. And Minna takes a leave of absence and takes Henrietta with her to Europe. Imagine that today. But they go off, and Minna is worried, even though she's devoted to this just magnetic young woman. She realizes that, she says in one letter, that even though their relationship has always been honest, that it was no way to go through life, and that just the secrecy, even in the 20s, the secrecy involved was in itself unhealthy. So she basically signs up her lover for psychoanalysis, and it was a nascent, very nascent profession at the time.
Well, we've only got about 30 seconds left. There's a lot more to tell, but I'm just wondering how your family feels about you putting Henrietta back up on the tree.
Well, the best story I can tell about that is, first of all, everyone has been more than cooperative and more than welcoming to have her back. And my youngest child, 11 years old, said to me the other day, "Mama, I want to hear all the Henrietta stories." And I'm so proud that now he and the rest of, you know, the readers out there will have a chance to see the arc of this amazing woman's life, someone who was almost, her need for love and her spirit were almost too large for her time, but maybe not for ours.
Emily Bingham, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Emily's new book, Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, and see photos of Henrietta at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the impact of incarceration on families and loved ones. We'll talk about that on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.